Good morning. We will call to order the meeting of the California Health Benefit Exchange. We will call the roll. Kim Belshe.
Here.
Bob Ross.
Here.
Paul Feerer.
Here.
Susan Kennedy will arrive shortly. I'm Diana Dooley. We will announce now, and we will ask again in the open session, the public session, if any board members have any conflicts to disclose. Seeing none, pursuant to Government Code Section 100500J, the board is adjourning into closed session. We intend to reconvene at 1 o'clock. We do have a number of complex contracting matters, and the extent to which we may go beyond 1 o'clock, we will advise both on our website and in the auditorium, but we will do everything we can to be back here to convene in open public session at 1 o'clock. Thank you. First of all, I am so sorry. I apologize most sincerely. I try to be so respectful of people's time, and our delay today is in no small measure to the fact that we have too much to do and too little time, as you all well understand. We are back in open session for the April 26th meeting of the California Health Benefit Exchange, and I appreciate your indulgence. Before we start this session this afternoon, the very first thing I want to do is to ask us all to take just a moment of silent reflection on the very sad passing recently of Rick Brown. Rick is known to so many of you. He founded the UCLA Center for Policy Research. We've worked so closely with him on CHIS and other matters. He's advised presidents and senators and so many of us. So if we could take just a moment and respect his work and what brings so many of us here as we are today in the very untimely passing of Rick Brown. Peter, I think you wanted to say something as well.
I had the privilege of working with Rick for many years. He was actually a board member of mine at the Center for Healthcare Rights, and I really do think that in many ways we would not be up on this stage without his work. And I think he's touched many of our lives, of folks in this room, and it really has been a privilege, and it's a tribute to all of our work, the work that he's done. And it's a good reminder that the work we do is an ongoing way, the best way we could possibly honor him. And what he's done is to continue the work that the Exchange is seeking to do. And it really was a privilege to know him, to work with him, and a privilege to be here carrying on his work, which he has been so dedicated for and been such a leader around. The other note, and I hate to, if I may, just for one moment, is to switch from the tragic to the happy, I'd also like to take a moment to say happy birthday to Diana Dooley, which is we had the ability to have a cake for the second anniversary of the Affordable Care Act in Fresno. We actually can think of that cake also in celebration of this one of Diana, but it says something about Diana's personal commitment that you wouldn't know it, that this is her birthday celebration, but she knows how to party. So this is with that, thank you.
And this isn't it. I would take just a moment again. At the beginning of each board meeting, when we do go into a closed session, there are so few of you here, but we do ask each member of the board to disclose any conflicts, and I would announce that we did that at the beginning of the meeting today, and there are no conflicts for any of the board members on any of the items that we have to consider today. So, Peter, if you would lead us off with the Executive Director's report.
Great. Let me just do a quick review of the today's agenda. After the Executive Director's report, we're going to have a planning status update, and then we'll be closing the meeting with a very look forward to panel on Small Business Health Options Program. Each of these four agenda items will have an opportunity for the public to comment, both in the room and generally. I will note, just so you're ready for us to take a stretch break, when we have the panel on the Small Employer Health Options Program, we're going to switch. The board and I will move down to the front row. The panel will get to come up here. So we all know that standing and stretching is a healthy thing.
Peter, I forgot one other bit of business before you continue. We have to approve the minutes. Again, we did that in the closed session of those minutes, but I would entertain a motion from the board on the approval of the minutes that were published.
So moved.
Sorry. Are there any questions or comments from the board? Are there any questions, comments, revisions, or additions from members of the public on the minutes that were posted? Seeing none, roll call, Kim Belshe, Dr. Ross, Paul Fearer,
aye.
Susan Kennedy,
aye.
Chair is aye. Okay, now to you. Thank
Great.
You.
Thank you very much. So the other two things I'd note on the agenda, when the board agenda was originally distributed, we noted that we were potentially going to be having a discussion of service center options. We subsequently updated that we are going to be carrying that discussion forward to June. In an earlier outline, we'd also know we were potentially going to be talking about the basic health program. We don't have updates on that, but I really want to note that people should know that tomorrow, and I believe it's at 10 a.m., the California Healthcare Foundation is sponsoring a meeting with the release of new data and updates on stakeholders' views of the basic health program that's going to be here at the Capitol. And so one of the reasons we didn't decide to double up relative to having a presentation here, there's going to be a presentation tomorrow that we'd encourage stakeholders to go participate in and get updated on those pieces. With that, let me go to a update on both closed session and some other issues. First, on the contracting front, the board received a report on the bids received and status of negotiations for the CalHERS contracting. As many of you know, the CalHERS is the California Healthcare Eligibility Enrollment and Retention System, the IT system that would support the eligibility for exchange as well as Medi-Cal and healthy families. Negotiations have not been finalized. Staff were given direction from the board relative to outstanding issues and directed to work with the vendor and also with the other project sponsors. Again, this is a tripartite procurement with DHCS and Mr. Mibb along with the exchange to consider as they go forward, and we anticipate a resolution to be at the next board meeting, which is currently scheduled for May 15th. The other two other issues on the contracting front, the board approved a engagement on a non-competitive bid basis with Milliman, which many of you know, did work for the exchange in terms of assessing essential health benefits, but to do further work to assess potential rate trends that may impact the qualified health plan, both program development and solicitations that we hope to come out in the fall. And so that was a additional contract that the board approved. And finally, we informed the board, and it's below the amount we need for board approval, but the engagement of the Center for Healthcare Decisions to do focus groups on consumer views on cost sharing. I'll talk more about that in a moment when we get into sort of the planning process. Next, on personnel matters. Last week we were able to announce, and this is one of those good news, bad news stories, we announced at our prior board meeting that Sharon Stevenson is going to be returning to the Department of Healthcare Services. Sharon has been a great asset and a pleasure to work with. And the only good news with her departure, well, there's two good news. One, we get to keep working with her. She'll be working with us in her role at DHCS. The other is we actually have someone who doesn't entirely fill her shoes because they fit a little differently, but also is a great person to join us, which is Gary Cohen, who's going to be joining the exchange as general counsel. Gary, most recently, is the director of the Oversight Group at the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight, or CSIO. He's been responsible for things like developing nationally the medical loss ratio rules, issues around risk adjustment. He knows California deeply and well. He was the general counsel of the California Department of Insurance. He was the general counsel of the Public Utility Commission. It's another person coming home, so to speak, and he'll be an asset to all of us, and we look forward to him joining us. The board also approved a number of potential appointments that we need to loop back with them before they go public, but stay tuned on those. And on the non-board appointments, I want to note new staff that have come on to the exchange. There's about six staff. I just want to let folks know we're continuing to grow the organization. First, I'd note that I'm really thrilled to note that Tien Lam, who has been on loan to us from Mr. Mibb since August, actually has just been appointed to join us as the Deputy Director of Eligibility Enrollment. And so Tien is Tien here. Tien. So, many of you know Tien, and Tien, and I want to note a specific thanks to Jeanette and Casillas and Mr. Mibb. We've been such incredibly close partners with Mr. Mibb, but also Department of Healthcare Services, and having Tien on board has been an absolute lifesaver. And it's a great example of us building deep bench strength of staff that have a good perspective of a range of programs and can roll up their sleeves and get the work we need to get done. I'm going to note we have another six hires that I'll just ask them all to stand if they're here. But Becky Patchen, new business manager, if they're here, stand or wave your arms. Juanita Balinski, budget analyst. They're all getting work done. I love that. Frederick Pilot, a policy analyst. Kelly Long, contract analyst. Jessica Abernathy, a regulatory specialist. A meek hand raised there. And Joan Bermudez, an executive assistant. They're right in back. So it's, again, growing the team is very, very important, and it is a great team that we're growing. Next, I wanted to provide an update on our visit that we had in the end of March to our federal colleagues, both at CSIO and in the White House, to report on the status of California's progress and to get an update on the federal progress in terms of getting the Affordable Care Act up and running, getting exchanges around the corner, around the country up and running. There will be posted on the exchange's website today, if not tonight, about an 80-slide set that we shared with them, which is our quarterly update as part of our belief in being transparent. It's a public document that we shared with our colleagues. It was a very constructive meeting. It was very positive, both in terms of them feeling that we were hitting the marks, doing well. They were impressed with the planning, impressed with the level of engagement of Californians across the board. Also, it was impressive from our perspective, and I talked to the board about this at some length, with the progress the federal government's making in setting up and being ready to have a federal exchange to support states that may not be as ready in terms of launching. And we spent an extensive time looking at what the federal government is doing in terms of their build for the federal exchange and potentially working in partnership with states. In that context, the board has asked staff to look at the federal capacity to consider the extent to which California might use a partnership option for some services that the federal government allows states to use as an interim basis to setting up a full autonomous state-based exchange. And so the exchange board has asked staff to look at that, look at what the options implications are, talk to other states that are partnering with the federal government, and talk to the federal government about what it would mean to have a partnership arrangement on our path to being a full state-based exchange. And that's something we'll be pursuing, again, to come back to the meeting in May with an update on what those options look like and what the implications are for that. Finally, as part of the executive director's report, I actually get the pleasure of not talking and listening to David Panish. One of the things at the last board meeting board members asked of staff is to get an update on legislation that is pending that may impact the exchange. And while I'd note that generally staff don't think it's timely or necessary at this moment to take positions on legislation. We do think it's appropriate that the board and generally the community understand what's in play and what may have implications to the exchange. And so with that, I would like to turn it to David Panush to provide an update. And there's, again, a document that the board has received that I think was out publicly and that will also be on our website that goes through these pieces of legislation. David.
Well, there we go. So as the legislative process gets off the ground, we've compiled an inventory of about 30 bills, which are in your packets, and they should be available on our website. These are bills that we'll be monitoring. They're the bills that affect the exchange in one way or another, and the list will also include two-year bills. And I want to especially thank Jessica Abernathy, who raised her hand earlier today, who just started with the exchange. This is her fourth day on the job. She helped compile this and will be helping us in the government relations shop. And so many of the stakeholders here will be getting to know her quite well. What I wanted to do today was to highlight just a few of the bills that we think are the most significant for the exchange. The first one is something that we've talked extensively about at earlier board meetings, and that's the two bills that relate to essential health benefits. What's significant to note here is that the two bills, AB 1453 and SB 951, are both carried by the two chairs of the Senate and Assembly Health Committees. They're both identical. Staffs are both the chairs of the committees and the staffs are working very closely together. They are tracking off of the work that the exchange had provided to them through the Milliman contract. You may recall that in December, the federal government issued their bulletin, which identified a process for figuring out what the essential health benefits might be. And we contracted with Milliman Consulting for that to give us an analysis of what the 10 potential benchmark options might be. The two bills have a couple of key components. The most important one is that the bills identify the Kaiser Small Group Plan as their suggestion for what the essential benchmark plan might be. There are also components on the definition of habilitative services and a recommendation on how pediatric oral care would be covered. Let's see. Aha. No. The second two bills I want to mention, again, both are carried by the two health chairs, AB 1461 and SB 961, which are the key. It's really the key package that will change. That will structure the individual market beginning in January 1st, 2014. The key components are requires these are the bills that conform to federal law and the requirement of guaranteed issue. They establish the open enrollment period and special enrollment periods that are consistent with the exchange rules. There are identification of rating factors that are limited to age, geographic region, and family size. And significantly, they also identify in the legislation what the geographic regions would be. And in this case, they're identified as the same as PERS, which also has, I believe it's, is it five regions? Five regions, okay. Just checking. The next slide is to give you a quick sense of some of the other key bills that we're tracking. SB 1761, which is authored by Speaker Perez, deals with the problem of deceptive marketing. This is an issue that I believe has been discussed at past board meetings. If you were to go, for example, to Google the California Health Benefit Exchange, you are likely to get CaliforniaHealthBenefitExchange.com, which is actually a website that is sponsored by the California Health Benefit Advisors, which is a network of health benefit consultants and brokers. And if there's any doubt about whether there is confusion about this, I had the experience of talking to a reporter who assured me that this was actually our website until she realized that when some of the tabs that I was trying to point her to were not on it. Although we don't have a formal position on this bill, I do want to thank the speaker and staff for introducing it, and I want to acknowledge the support of the broker community and Health Access for supporting it. AB 1846 is sponsored by the Insurance Commissioner, and it deals with the issue of consumer-operated and oriented plans, or co-ops. Under the Affordable Care Act, there's a federal pot of about $6 billion for startup loans to help new nonprofit member-run health insurance issuers. The exchange would be required to contract with these co-ops. At issue is what the regulatory framework should be, and the bill sets up a structure under the Department of Insurance. We would note that it's opposed by Health Access, and it's something that we're going to be looking very closely at. AB 2508 prohibits state agencies from contracting with a call center unless the work is done by California workers. Sponsored by the Western Center on Law and Poverty and the California Labor Federation, there's a particular focus about outsourced, at least according to the analysis, a particular focus about an outsourcing contracts in the CalWORKs and CalFresh world with a vendor that has a call center in Juarez, Mexico. But because it does mention the exchange is something, again, that we're going to be looking closely at. Finally, SB 940 requires CalHERS to implement horizontal integration in the area of human service programs by 2015. It's also sponsored by the Western Center. It's something that we understand the author is considering language to add a provision so it would only go into effect if it did not affect the CalHERS implementation October 2013 date. So, again, that's another one that's on our list to watch closely. Just as a word about process, the first big deadline for the legislature is to move the policy bills out of their first policy committee, which will be tomorrow. After that, they have to go through a long and dangerous road as they go out of House of Origins and by June 1. There's a fair to good chance that these bills will be changing significantly over time, and so it's important that we keep an eye on them. In addition, Jessica and I, along with the exchange staff, have a lot of work to do to get them built, to get the bills analyzed, to understand what the impact may or may not be on the exchange, on our mission and operations, what the concerns are, and how they might be best addressed. We need to understand what the author's intent might be and what alternatives might be available. So I want to stress the importance as we're moving through this experience with the legislature, my old home, that we have to work very closely with the legislative leadership and the administration, our partners. They're very committed to the success of the exchange. Keeping them looped in and aware of our concerns is clearly going to be a priority. At the next board meeting, we want to provide you with both an update on legislation, but also some thoughts and recommendations on an internal process so the exchange's concerns can be shared appropriately and addressed as the bills move through the process. Moving to regulations. You may recall at the last meeting, we also provided you a very high-level overview of the regulations that had been issued by the federal government in February and March. At this stage, there are a number of interim rules that were off. I'm sorry. When these regulations were offered, there were a number of interim rules which required, or for which there was an invitation for comment if people wanted to, if stakeholders wanted and states wanted to do that. In most of the areas that were identified as areas that we could comment on, most are in the Medi-Cal eligibility world, and so we've been working with the Department of Healthcare Services and Mr. Mibb, really have taken the lead on doing the analysis. However, the deadline for these comments is mid-May, and we don't know if there will be a need or if our partner departments will want to make a formal response, but we do think that if they do, we should be prepared to participate in that, in those comments. And so we are suggesting that there, that the board consider a resolution that would give the executive director the authority to sign on in a letter to the federal government on these comments.
Would you like us to take that up now, the resolution?
The executive director is nodding at me. That would be a good idea.
Okay.
So, yes.
See, I was looking to you, David.
Okay.
The item was noticed, and it is in the packet of material. Are there any? Well, first, I would entertain a motion to adopt the resolution. Is there a second? Is there any question or discussion from members of the board? No, I'm going to wait and do that. I'm just going to do the resolution. Are there any public comments about the resolution? I'll take public comment on the rest of the report in a minute, but just specific to this resolution. Seeing none, a roll call. Kim Belcher.
Aye.
Bob Ross.
Aye.
Paul Feerer.
Aye.
Susan Kennedy.
Aye.
The chair is aye. Thank you.
And with that, you can go to our website on... And go to the right one, too, not the .com.
Yeah.
Anyway, if there are questions.
Thank you, David. Are there questions or comments from members of the board for Mr. Panish or Mr. Lee in the executive director's report? And then we'll open it for public comment. Kim.
Get the lights back on.
Thank you.
Ah. Wow.
Good. David or Peter, in terms of the individual market reform bills and the provision that calls for the geographic regions to be the same as PERS for 2014, have we given some thought to how to think about geographic regions? I know it's going to be important to be as fully aligned with other purchasers as possible, but any initial considerations regarding how we might be thinking about geographic regions?
You know, the core of the individual market legislation is that the rules that apply to the exchange need to apply to the outside individual market. And so whatever they are, they have to be compatible with both. So, you know, is the ideal version the five that were chosen by the legislature? Well, if they get a signature and they get votes, I guess it will be. But... In terms, there are a number of discussion points that one could have about the various merits of one configuration over another, and I think that's one of the things that both the exchange staff and our actuary experts will have to sort through with their legislative colleagues.
Yeah, I would just add to that that back to the context of evidence-based policymaking, these regions matter a lot, and making sure that you have in the same region areas that are priced similarly is going to be very important for the exchange because of how plans coming in the exchange that may not be in an entire region or a part of a region to be fairly treated, having the regions be well-drawn matters. So we're starting to look at that issue, and we know that the legislative staff and others are as well.
Any other questions or comments from members of the board? Thanks, David. Don't go far, because we may have other questions from members of the public. Are there any comments or questions on the executive director's report or on David Panish's legislative report? Beth Capel.
Beth Capel, Health Access California. We are interested to hear consideration of the possibility of a partnership option. We are very eager to have the exchange operational and able to enroll people in October of 2013, and anything that assures that that can occur in a timely manner is something that we will be supportive of. We are also over the longer run, would hope that we will have a fully operational California exchange because we're California and we do it our way, and because there will be things that are particular to California that we need to be mindful of. But we are, as I say, Health Access is first objective is to make sure that people, Californians, get the benefits of federal health reform on January 1, 2014. Thank you.
That's why we're all here. Thanks, Beth. Thank you. There are no calls in the queue from the web or the phone. So seeing no other public comment here, I will turn it back to you, Peter, for the exchange planning status.
Great. Thank you very much. A quick update, we'll see how quick it is, on our planning status. And at the last few board meetings, we've done this, an opportunity to sort of look 3 to 6 months out. As you know, we are moving rapidly to reach just what Beth just spoke about, is to make sure that we are enrolling people in October, that we're reaching out to them well before that, that we have many people enrolled and getting coverage effective January 1, 2014. And what I'd like to note is that we're going to be moving ahead on many fronts. And can we turn on the overhead so I'll go through the slides? Is as you all know, we have range of issues that we're making decisions around, and you're familiar with these slides. Many of you could probably recite them in your sleep. I won't make you. But we have issues before the board on business operations, communications, enrollment, et cetera. Central to that is when we think about planning for our Level 2 grant, there's a number of elements that we need to build in for what we're going to the federal government for. And what I'm going to do in running through this is talk about the work that staff are doing, that staff are doing with consultants, and lay out the time frame, again, of what's coming up, but also to lay out, not for decision for the board, but for discussion for the board, a couple issues that are in some ways setting the table for issues that we need to make decisions on soon, one of which is on stakeholder engagement. As part of our Level 2 grant, we can and want to go back and frame our ongoing stakeholder engagement process. Another is on setting up criteria and guidelines for our qualified health plan strategy. Each of these are not going to be decision items for the board, but they're going to be discussion topics as I go through this presentation. So let me just run through the next six board meetings quickly. We're here in April looking at our planning process, shop landscape, and the potential action of the CalHERS decision, which, as I noted, is going to be coming up in May instead. May 15th, we're currently scheduled to have a meeting that would have a lot on our agenda. And believe it or not, we're going to speed up in the pace on which we do things, because to get a bunch of decisions made over the next 2 months, we're going to be bringing options before the board, in many cases without recommendations, but saying, here's two or three options, let's get comment and discussion. In other cases, options, and we think this is the right way to go, an option and a recommendation, but we'll constantly do that as a two-step, either options or options and recommendations, publicly vetted, board an opportunity to kick the tires, and then next meeting, sharpening based on the discussion with the board, sharpening with consumer, provider, other input, making a decision that then would either be part of the Level 2 grant or part of our general policy. So that's going to be the sequence you see throughout of having information for information discussion, and then issues that will be brought forward for action. I would note that we've already added a second June board meeting. So we have a June 12th board meeting that we're currently looking at having for discussion, a sisters and brokers scope, Level 2 grant outline, with having had options for those on assisters and navigators in May. Similarly, options for SHOP in May with decision that would leap into June 19th. It is likely we will be adding another May board meeting, and stay tuned on that. We will obviously keep you posted. I will underscore that this is a working timeline. So the items on it may change. We will always let you know at least 10 days ahead of time when we're going to have board meetings. But we have a lot before us, and so to make sure that we have time for due deliberation, we may be adjusting our time frames. Going to June 19th, again, issues continued from the June 12th meeting. We're making hopefully final decisions, including on SHOP policies and on finalizing elements for the Level 2 grant. On our current schedule, the Level 2 grant needs to be submitted June 29th. Okay. Looking into July and August, we're looking at the July meeting, which is scheduled to be in San Francisco, location to be determined, on the basic design, network, other major options as options for the qualified health plan. Then the following meeting, actual recommendations and actions by the board. Again, two-step process continually of engaging the broad community with what we think options are, making recommendations potentially, and then the board making decisions at the following meeting. So that's a high level of what's coming down the track. I'd like to note, in addition, though, to the formal board process, we intend to have additional stakeholder input forums and to have either by webinar, public meetings, or otherwise, sharing of recommendations that we're considering for navigators, for outreach, service center, shop, these weeks. And again, we'll let people know. It'll be posted on our website, and we'll send out a calendar to everyone on our listserv. So before the board meeting, people have time to kick the tires, to say, what's this idea about? What does this mean? Let's understand this. So the board gets the full opportunity to hear views, perspectives of the broad range of stakeholders. We also do plan on having in May a session on options with regard to outreach strategies and navigators. We have a lot of interest areas, so before we get to baked recommendations, we want to have a stakeholder engagement around that. I would note, as part of this discussion, though, I mean, we have been and continue to be deeply committed to having evidence-based policymaking informed by stakeholders. We've been very involved in the 1296 stakeholder engagement process with Department of Healthcare Services, Mr. Mibb, Office of Patient Advocate. We look for opportunities constantly to reach out. And the other piece, as I move into some of the substantive areas, every area we're working in, we're developing options based on and driven by the meetings we've been having, the letters we've gotten, the testimony received, the reports on how stakeholders view a range of things. So it isn't the case ever of staff or the consultants we're working with developing concepts out of whole cloth. It's out of the substantial outreach work we've been doing. With that, I want to move to talking about stakeholder engagement. So, and the board, and this is a material that you received separately, has a memo on this that basically lays out, thinking about stakeholder engagement, what are we doing now and what might we do differently going forward? So in terms of stakeholder engagement, we do a lot, I think. It feels like quite a bit, in a very good way. The monthly board meetings are very much geared to be interactive. That for those of you that were not able to be with us in Fresno, I really want to note it was so great having live, real-time translation services for about 20 Hmong speakers who had real-time translation, and for Spanish language speakers who did not otherwise speak English who had real-time translation there during the meetings. That's a service that we are willing to offer at other meetings, but it was great. It's the sort of thing we want to do in terms of having outreach be real and meaningful. We share reports. We solicit material through our distribution list. We're engaging in tribal consultation. We have one-on-one meetings. And those are some of the board and ongoing processes. In terms of work groups, we currently have an individual and a small business work group that has provided a lot of help for us in framing standardized questions in the area of qualified health plans and outreach strategies. We've held series of ad hoc meetings with small groups around the state. We posted questions, and it has led to a very robust set of input to the board. That doesn't mean we don't think we can improve. So what we have as three options for the board to consider, and again, this is not for final action, but to generate some discussion amongst the board and then able to have a community response, and we'll flesh out and revise the recommendations. We've considered three options going forward. And this would be to first have, instead of two, have three specific, topic-specific advisory groups that would be formalized and ongoing. One potentially on plan management, one on communications and outreach, and one on the Small Employer Health Options Program. Second, an option we looked at is having regional advisory groups. We recognize that California is a very big state, and issues of rural Californians are not the same as they are for folks in downtown Los Angeles, are not the same in San Diego. and the issue of having ad hoc groups, convening around the state as an ad hoc basis. Our working recommendation, and then I'm going to actually pause here to have some discussion and questions from the board of myself, and then again we'll have public comment on this after I go through this whole planning process, is first to continue the current stakeholder engagement activities through 2012, which is our two existing advisory bodies we'll use on a periodic basis. But effective 2013, convene and form these three, using option one, advisory groups that would meet probably quarterly to advise the board. And the concept being that these be pretty small groups. They're small enough that they can really work together. They be relatively expert, relatively knowing issues around. If it's an outreach and communications, is it potentially having the director of outreach for the San Francisco Giants, the CEO of La Pinon, folks that can really help us think about things strategically, ideally, potentially with a board member joining in those advisory working groups, with the concept that those meetings would absolutely be open to the public and have opportunity for public to comment as well, but a small group instead of having huge, dozens of huge large bodies. But also to continue having ad hoc groups as needed and doing those specifically to make sure we get around the state. I mean, recognizing that having a richness of the texture of input we get by getting, with all due respect, out of Sacramento was important. But rather than set up an infrastructure, we need the support of having a Central Valley Advisory Committee and a Northern California, Northern Rural, et cetera, to do that through the ad hoc process. So I'd actually like to pause here to get both initial questions, comments, reactions from the board. This is not an action item. This is a discussion topic that will feed into our refreshing. This is a set of recommendations we'll bring back at a future board meeting.
Are there any questions? Kim.
Peter, we are a startup, so we have we are mighty, if not many. And one of the ways we have endeavored to build our capacity is through our contract partners, who are essential components of the work we're doing together. Can you say a little bit more about how our contract partners, and maybe using the Ogilvy and Richard Heath contract as an example, elaborate a bit more in terms of what kind of outreach or stakeholder engagement efforts they're undertaking in the course of their work?
It's a great, I actually see different sorts of contract partners. There's one sort of contract partner, to my mind, which are expert but extensions of staff, and another is contract partners thinking down the road of, for instance, the health plans we'll be contracting with. And they're somewhat different. We've actually sought to restrain our existing contractors, both PwC in developing the qualified health plan and Ogilvy and Heath, from doing outreach. We think it's important that we have developed and given to them a huge amount of comments that the board has received, that's been transparent, that everyone has seen. And having that generally be understood and public, we think is very important. So we've actually discouraged them and said that the input should be with staff there and in some public ways so it can be understood where there's those input opportunities. So I think a separate question we'll need to get to is how do we engage health plans that will be going through a solicitation process and engaging, and I'm not sure about that. So the other piece, though, that where we have specifically engaged in the case of Ogilvy, questions around consumers' perspective, branding, they're holding focus groups. But that's a different kind of – that's an expert-based way to pull together, and I'm going to talk some about that in a moment, of bringing together – panels of individuals, some Spanish-speaking, some English-speaking, income levels specific to the exchange, to as true consumer focus groups getting their perspective.
It'll be helpful to hear more about that because just to underscore, there's some very purposeful and strategic approaches they're undertaking to elicit
Absolutely.
Input to inform
Absolutely.
What they'll be coming back
yeah. with. And the same thing I'd note in terms of, while not sponsored by Pricewaterhouse, we, as I noted in my earlier report, we've engaged the Center for Healthcare Decisions, which has done a lot of the best work in the country about helping people think about decision-making in healthcare, to sponsor a dozen focus groups of consumers who are exchange eligible sort of income range to help us think about cost sharing. And so this is, again, doing outreach to get anchored in consumers' experience. One of our number one values is to be consumer-centered, speaking to consumers, getting their views to inform the board and inform stakeholders writ large is central.
Bob.
Peter, I just want to thank you and the staff for continuing to be thoughtful and mindful and expansive about stakeholder engagement and outreach. And I look forward, Madam Chair, to any comments from the public today about where we may be coming up short, or at least perceptions of us coming up short. So
thank
remain
you.
Open, but nice job, Peter, to you and the staff.
Do you want to take those comments now or at the
end? No, let's go through and comment on other parts of the planning process. But I would note that, we're wrestling with issues of what's the right size of an advisory group? Who should be in the composition? And again, by setting ourselves up to have a process not tomorrow, but in 2013, we can get comment from stakeholders on what's the right size, what are the sorts of attributes of membership. Should they be public? And we think absolutely they should. How do you engage others that aren't members, et cetera, is something we very much welcome folks' thoughts on. And I would note also that the structure we provided to the board, and you've seen of this options memo, is something that you'll get familiar with, because we have a lot of decisions we need to make. We're trying to queue them up in an efficient way of here's the issue, here's some background, here's some options, here's a recommendation. So this is a little bit of get ready, all of us, for our need to stand them up and knock them down. No, not in a bad way, but in a good way, of framing issues thoughtfully, sharpening them, moving them along. So the next
Speaking of moving along,
thank you. Comments at the end of the whole planning is next issue I'll go to is on the qualified health plan planning process. First, we've developed, and I'm going to pause and get comments on that from the board and then from the public at large, on a set of guidelines. One of the things we think is going to be helpful as we get into making a lot of, in sometimes granular and sometimes big picture issues, is saying we have an overall set of visions and values. Is there a more discrete set of guidelines that may frame what we do around qualified health plans? Is there a discrete set of guidelines for outreach? And we're going to seek to develop those to help frame what we're doing. And this, I would note, is a product of the work being done by both staff and the interim lead there is Andrea Rosen with the team at Pricewaterhouse with the Pacific Business Group on Health, and have been doing really phenomenal work going through a lot of issues. So we finalized and are finalizing the stakeholder input report. At the meeting in Fresno, you heard from Katie Marcellus on a report that summarized the background on outreach, navigators, et cetera. We have a similar report that we look forward to releasing in May on the range of input, the responses to questions on the qualified health plan, delivery reform strategies. I noted the exchange will sponsor, using the Center for Healthcare Decisions, 10 focus groups, two of which are going to be in Spanish, on gauging the reaction of consumers to different cost-sharing arrangements. We're continuing issue identification, preparing for the Level 2 grant, and we're continuing to meet with both consumers, providers, plans to help inform the development of the options that are coming before the board. In doing that, we've looked at the issue of having a set of guidelines that we can then return to say, how do we pick this policy versus that policy? And one of the things we've noted is that for everything we do, virtually there's going to be trade-offs. There's going to be trade-offs between, for instance, potentially cost and access, potentially between efficiencies and inclusivity. And those sort of issues, we want to, as much as possible, not pretend they don't exist, but be clear about them and be clear when we're making trade-offs. The board has received a draft set of guidelines. Again, this is not for action today, and we welcome both board members' comments on that. That would frame 7 guidelines that would be a frame through which we'll look at the raft of policy issues that need to be made in setting up the qualified health plan strategy. And they start with promoting affordability, which we've heard again and again. The second is how is it assuring access to care and continuity of care, facilitating informed choice, promoting wellness, reducing health disparities, being a catalyst for delivery reform, and operating with speed and agility. And I note, this is a high-level note, and I'm not going to try to have en masse us wordsmith these, though I, of course, always welcome board members wordsmithing. Underneath these, note in affordability, we have, 7 examples of policies that might promote affordability. And so it actually, it isn't keeping it in the 30,000 foot. It's trying to bring it down to thinking, what are some of the policies that we can be looking at that provide for a framing and guidelines that will help staff working with PwC prepare options such that when they come to the board and are come public, say, oh, we understand why you've come to that option, because that really is anchored in this mix of, we've said we want to address wellness and continuity. Those really speak to that. So those are the sorts of things we wanted to do. So I'm going to pause again to see if there's questions or reactions from the board. Again, welcoming comments from the public after we go through my entire report, but also welcoming specific comments, you know, offline and afterwards if you have red line or specific thoughts about specific elements.
Seeing none.
Seeing none. Okay. Next element I'll turn to is the outreach update of what's been completed and in process. And again, in this area, this is the product of good work being done by the team at Ogilvy with Heath. A couple things that I'd note of what's been done. They've been reviewing best practices, what other states have done, learning from either planning work in the case of Maryland, D.C., Colorado, but what Massachusetts has actually done, looking at key goals, looking at research, building on the research we've already done with UCLA to look in more detail at small business studies. So, again, they have adopted our practice of evidence-based decision-making. In terms of what's what is underway and ongoing, I want to note about focus groups. There have already been conducted 4 focus groups, two of them have been in Los Angeles, 2 in Fresno. A couple things that I'd like to note on these, and I don't want to steal the thunder. There will be a very public report on these. There's going to be more of these. But I'd like to spend a brief moment to sort of steal from the report that we just got yesterday. So these were separate focus groups for men and women, on some theory that they approach healthcare differently. One each in Fresno and in Los Angeles was Spanish only. The other was English and Spanish. And this is on individuals who were uninsured, but in the eligible for subsidy category, and some even non-subsidy, the vast majority in the 138 to 300 or so percent of poverty. And a couple things that I'd note that is first a really dramatic and real sense in the daily lives of Californians of how much they struggle with health care as a burning concern, and something that Larry Bai, who helped organize these, coined a term, which is a culture of coping. Is folks are figuring out ways to do workarounds without health insurance, but it's not pretty. It is folks that are avoiding care, going to emergency rooms. Literally one individual, a Hispanic man who talked about having a very bad cut on his hand that happened in his workplace. He had to get back to work. He sewed his hand up himself. This sorts of real life experience that is, again, we often talk about a culture of coverage. The reality today is a culture of coping for millions of Californians. The other thing that came across was that this worry about healthcare as a daily worry, a worry about if I get sick, if something bad happens, how can I care for my family? How can I make sure that I continue doing that? Worry about their life savings being wiped out. These are people that want insurance coverage, that look at the prospect of what the exchange is doing as vitally important. Some of the messages that resonated well with these groups were this concept of a marketplace, and we'll talk more about that, being trustworthy, being reliable. But one of the notes that I liked a lot was, show me, don't tell me. Prove it that you're going to be trustworthy. Don't say you're the trustworthy source. One stop, help understand and compare options, make access to affordable care. Some of the messages with regard to economic security rang relatively well. Prevention rang well. Access to care. Not so much general well-being, and this sort of, with all due respect to our friends at Kaiser, the Thrive mentality was a, it's a, no, I'm going to get in trouble. But yeah, thank you. Okay, sorry. is a, also, what didn't ring so well is you got a responsibility to have insurance. A lot of positive view of it being a community issue, but not so much, you know, the issue of testing this concept of a mandate. People don't really like mandates. They like the fact that there's a community sense, but that didn't ring so well. But we'll be doing more focus groups, and they're reaching out of identifying the whole range of partnerships and developing background material for the Level 2 grant and developing the program for ongoing press and PR responsibilities. The other thing I'd note that they're working on is developing two distinct but interrelated positionings. The first is this branding of the new marketplace. And again, it was some of the things they're testing in these focus groups of a website portal that leads to insurance options, a where you can get access to affordable care, financial support, and how does that relate to this idea of coverage itself. And these are things that they're testing. And again, we need to look at how do we market, what do we market. And importantly, we're looking at what other states have done their own testing on. Other states are doing focus groups. We don't want to just figure we're starting from scratch. And there is a lot of states that are finding this idea of the marketplace testing well. I will note that while the concept of marketplace tests well, it's not clear that mercado is the right way to translate it. Now, that's the Spanish for market, spoken probably with a bad Italian accent. We need to figure out, again, branding and marketing that is culturally and language specific. So we marketplace may work in English. It may be a different phrase in Spanish. With that, I want to note the updates on the assister program. The under and working with Ogilvy is Heath and Associates, which is looking at developing recommendations from analyzing the research submitted, looking at material that we've submitted from the range of comments received, and they'll be developing a whole range of recommendations, and I'm going to fly through these. Again, we plan on having these shared publicly in an informal session in May before coming to the full board, and it's going to look at eligibility standards, training, compensation structures, and they're rolling up their sleeves using, again, the information already received through a range of comments. With that, I'd see if there's more questions from the board before soliciting public comment and question.
None at this point. We would invite the public now to ask questions, make comments on any of the items in the executive director's report. Hello again.
Hi. Beth Capel for Health Access. And first of all, we do want to acknowledge that the board and staff have been available to many of us in not only the public setting, but in, as we're calling it, ad hoc meetings. We would very much encourage that the staff be the ones who take the public input rather than the consultants. We think that the experience of high-speed rail suggests that to do it otherwise created some problems in that setting. We would note, as you think about the stakeholder process, that the assister role is somewhat different than the broad outreach marketing role and might require separate conversation. With respect to cost-sharing, and I'm sorry, Peter, you covered a lot of ground. With respect to cost-sharing, as you think about the options, I know you will think about the impact on adverse selection. It may not be what's discussed with consumers. We do worry about consumer literacy. We are often asked whether premiums count towards out-of-pocket costs, for example. Finally, with respect to affordability, 2 points. I think for most consumers, they compare it to what they'd get in job-based coverage because that's the most common experience of coverage. And inherently, the exchange is going to be less affordable in terms of out-of-pocket costs than job-based coverage just because of the 70% actuarial value, which is so much less than employment-based coverage. With respect to premiums, however, because it's based on income, it may in fact be somewhat more affordable than because it's a percent of income rather than a percent of premium. So that actually, I think we've thought about affordability in terms of the total premium, but that's not the way people are going to experience it. I'm pleased to hear about the focus groups. I think much of it mirrors the research that Health Access has been involved in over the last decade. Men and women do think very differently about healthcare. And we will look forward to hearing more of the results as they come forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Beth.
Madam Chair, board members, Chad Silva, Latino Coalition for Healthy California. In regarding the stakeholder engagement plan, we're very happy to see that you've put a lot of thought into that. With respect to the idea that you need to have smaller groups engaging in the hard work so that you don't unduly burden the process, I also want to make sure that this sort of exclusivity doesn't also include exclusionary, sort of processes. And just that's one thing that we're worried about. We understand you need to get it to work. We understand you need to, the experts. We also want to make sure that's expansive and diverse. And I very much appreciate you bringing up the fact that the Central Valley needs to be engaged, and we need to do it in a much more regional level. So I really appreciate that. But we are sort of concerned about some of the language in here. With regard to your overall plan as far as I'm referring to this document here, the Qualified Health Plan document. We really appreciate item 4, the fact that you are calling out prevention and wellness. In our mind, the big paradigm shift has to be in prevention and wellness. We are stuck in a continuous circle of addressing after effects of disease instead of preventing disease. And so we are very, very happy to see that that has been called out as a specific objective here. And as well, we also like the fact that you've called that delivery system reform. Is an object here, because in our mind as well, if we're talking about prevention and wellness, we also need to be talking about how we deliver that care, how we engage the population, and who's going to be delivering the services. And we look forward to future conversations with you on these subjects. Thank you.
Thank you, Chad.
Gil Ojeda, California Program and Access to Care, UC Berkeley. A point of information and a bit of a cautionary note. Okay, we just did one of our capital briefings. We do those half a dozen times a year, and we held one on this process of consumer engagement under healthcare reform. We kind of called it internally in our offices more the battle of the bands, because what we did is we brought the high caps in conjunction with the HCA, which did the contracting for the Office of the Patient Advocate and the recent $1.5 million initiative, and as well as the Susie Shoup's group, the Healthy Kids groups. And basically what we're trying to do is draw a contract about techniques and specific approaches. What kind of information do people actually need in order to give the consumers that are concerned about it, both on people that are part of the culture of coverage, if you will, and those that aren't, okay? And we think that the cautionary note here is that by the way, there were about 9 presenters, and we looked at these various pieces, and we had several UC investigators. We had looked at legally limited English speakers. And you mentioned that the Ogilvy is part of the contract, I understand, is that, we got all the information we need. Now we're going to analyze this. We're going to do a few focus groups. But I think it leaves out the process of engaging with efforts like ours and efforts like other ones, where I think it closes them down to drawing some of the input that they're going to need in terms of doing those products at the end of those first 90 days. I think the idea of them not doing anything else but the work that's been provided by the staffing process is limiting. Okay, and the work, for instance, that we did at that session on April 12th, I thought it would have been useful to them. There were a couple of people in the audience from Ogilvy. We kind of picked them out. They're not supposed to announce themselves, if you will. So I think it's useful that we can both share that product with all the senior staff. In fact, one of the members of the Exchange Board was actually there. Okay, but also that in the process, let's open up the kind of dialogue that Ogilvy, as well as Richard Heath, are going to have with the various expert parties that are out here.
Thank you, Gil.
Good afternoon, Elizabeth Landsberg.
Sorry about that. You're done, Elizabeth. That was great. I'm sorry.
I get 2 seconds, Peter.
You're so concise.
I will be concise. On the stakeholder process, we do want to thank Exchange staff for participating in the AB 1296 process, and I think it's been a good example of focusing on specific issues, keeping it open, but having a depth of issue that not everyone wants to talk about the details of Magi and household composition, but we've appreciated the participation and would hope that moving forward we can continue to have a venue for talking about the eligibility enrollment single application system. I don't think I ever introduced myself. Elizabeth Landsberg with the Western Center on Law and Poverty and also a member of the Health Consumer Alliance. As it relates to the outreach and enrollment and branding, we've really appreciated the joint approach by the triumvirate of the exchange, DHCS and Mr. Mibb, and the acknowledgement that consumers don't know when they're coming in what they're eligible for. We do have some concerns with the notion of talking about it as a marketplace because this will be free coverage for many people on Medi-Cal. So we hope that as you do the focus groups, you're also looking at the many people who won't have to pay for coverage and want to make sure that calling it a marketplace doesn't dissuade them from joining as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Betsy, if I could ask you to hold just a moment. We have one caller on the line. If you could put that caller through, operator, please.
Yes, and that is for Abigail Corsol. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Abigail Corsol with the National Health Law Program and also with the Health Consumer Alliance. Thank you for allowing me to comment today. I want to thank the board and Peter Lee for presenting these documents, especially for the materials on the QHP planning process and on the consumer engagement. As Elizabeth just mentioned, the Health Consumer Alliance has been very involved in that process, and we're very interested in working with the board once this report comes to fruition to make sure that outreach and engagement of consumers through the exchange and the other insurance affordability programs is very robust. On the topic of stakeholder engagement, we are very encouraged and look forward to working with the board to refine the proposals that are here before the board today. We think that the proposals for committees and membership are a really promising start, and we look forward to working with you all further to make sure that those committees are robust and inclusive. We also do applaud this two-step process that was introduced today to ensure that there is ample time for everyone to see materials and digest them. But even so, we board to post materials as early as possible on the website to ensure that all stakeholders have time to digest materials and engage accordingly. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Abigail, and I will comment on that point. We have so much to do that we are doing everything we can to get materials out as early as we can, but rather than wait till another board meeting, we do err on the side of getting material late rather than having to wait another board member board meeting. So, we were all reading the last addendum to our binders late last night as well, and so I would just ask for your continued indulgence, at least, in these first 6 to 8, 12 months, as we power toward this looming deadline, we're all going to have to be patient with one another. So I appreciate the comment about the timeliness of the documents. We're doing all that we can, but we want not to let the process of enough lead time get in the way of meeting our deadline in January 2014. Betsy.
I'll use 2 seconds to say happy birthday, Secretary.
Oh, thank you.
And on the stakeholder process, we've really been appreciative of the various kinds of input that we've been allowed to give, both in the small groups where we had more dialogue, and then the written templates. Although we cringed at the big charts, it was actually very helpful, and it gave us time because there was a little leeway there, a few weeks, to actually do some research and hopefully give you some citations that would be concrete and helpful. We look forward to reactivating the existing work groups on the individual and the SHOP programs, and do look forward to these ongoing topic groups because I think the continuing conversation is really important. This policy stuff it's complicated, and the iterative process is important, and it gives us all time to sort of think through things step by step and stay up with the process. On the issue of plan choice and focus groups, glad you're doing it. We think it's terrific. And Consumers Union as well is doing some, both focus groups and some literature review on choice, the academic research that's out there, and we'll be happy to share that with you as soon as we have it. Thank you.
Thanks, Betsy. Are you thriving?
I'm following the chair's admonition to be patient. Bill Worley,
you can have
the
extra 3 seconds, Bill.
Peter, earlier in your presentation, the timeline talks about
You identify yourself, Bill.
Bill Worley with Kaiser Permanente, where we thrive once you become a member. If you're uninsured, you can't thrive because you're not in Kaiser Permanente. In your presentation, you talked about a bucket of decisions that are needed to complete the Level 2 planning grant and then others that tend to come later. If not now, at some point, could you give us a little bit more guidance about what kinds of decisions you're putting in that bucket? That would be helpful to us as we try to plan to keep up with you.
Great.
So, thanks.
Thanks, Bill.
Hi, Carrie Sanders with CPenn. Thank you. And as one of the groups that unwittingly broke your rule by contacting the your contractors, I just want to thank you for the clarification. And just to reiterate, we really do appreciate how transparent the process is and how open and engaging it has been for the various opportunities to comment, whether it's, you know, written comments, you know, coming and testifying at the board. We do our best to respond to every opportunity, sometimes better than others, but hopefully, you know, we've been able to have some good dialogue and iterative work together. Just a couple things on the qualified health plans. Appreciate the guidance, including prevention wellness and also health disparities and quality care as included as well, because we think that's important. On the focus groups, really glad to hear that's happening, that you're beginning to get some of that important anecdotal information that will help to really help you think about the messages. And I wanted to just mention that we're also doing some focus groups in four different ethnic communities right now. We're looking forward to. We should have some results to share, hopefully, by the next meeting. So it's been very interesting in our own process as well, just to see differences between and amongst communities about what they how they would like to learn about health coverage options and the extent to which, you know, they want a .gov versus a no.gov. So look forward to sharing that, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Carrie. If we could hold just a moment. Oh, they left the line. Thank you. Please come.
Judy Gould, California Dietetic Association. I have a comment and a question. You know, we're certainly glad to see that prevention is being included, and just a reminder that in some cases, treatment is prevention, especially for diabetes and gestational diabetes. Those are kind of two big examples. The question I have is, it's not clear to me whether you're using assisters, navigators, and promotoras interchangeably, whether they're all different. Excuse my mangled Spanish. So if someone could clarify that either now or later, that would be good.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Peter.
Great. I'll do a working clarification now, but stay tuned. Is the major distinction we're generally using, and again, this will be sharpened as we move along, is navigators will be likely paid by the exchange. Assisters will be a lot of other folks helping. And we think there will need to be and will be a lot of folks that want to help people enroll. We anticipate providing training, support for a lot of folks. How we structure compensation arrangements, though, will be more specific. And so one of the reasons we did the general note on assisters is we think we need to be supporting people that are ready to do a whole range of things, whether or not they may or may not get compensated. And again, within each of those, whether it's there's a lot of other typologies of promotores or advocates, or there's hundreds of labels of people that may assist or be a navigator. But that's the long and short. But stay tuned, and you'll see it in writing, and with lots of opportunities for engage and input. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
I'm Ivana Krejcinovic with United Here Health. I'm here mostly to translate for the next speaker.
Thank you very much.
Mi nombre es Norberto Gutierrez.
My name is Norberto Gutierrez.
Trabajo en el Silver Skillet.
I work at the Silver Skillet.
Un restaurante pequeño.
A small restaurant.
Y tengo como 13 años trabajando.
I've been there 13 years.
Y gano 8.25 la hora.
I make 8.25 an hour.
Y necesito que baje la aseguranza.
I really need the insurance to go down.
Porque cada vez que voy al doctor tengo que pagar por la visita.
Every time I go to the doctor, I have to pay for the visit.
Y tengo que pagar por mi medicina.
I also pay for the medicine.
Y tengo una esposa.
I have a wife.
Dos niños.
And two children.
Y mi hija quiere ir a la universidad.
My daughter wants to go to the university.
Y no hay dinero para poderlos mandar.
And there's not money to send her.
Gracias.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention that part of the reason that Norberto makes $825 is that he hasn't had a raise in 8 years, because every time we sit down to negotiate with this employer, a small business, all the money goes to paying for health care. So certainly doing something about the price of health care for workers at small businesses will do put more money in their pockets and allow them to send their kids to university. Thank you.
Please give Norberto our appreciation. And would you identify yourself, please, and which group you're with?
Yeah, I said Ivana Krajcinovic, United Here Health.
United Healthcare. Thank you. Thank you, Norberto.
If I could just say a note both to Roberto and to thank you for having him testify, is that one of the things we're looking at Outreach is there are over 500,000 Californians who work in food service who don't have health insurance. So Roberto is a name, a voice, a face of, again, almost 500,000 other Californians who are in restaurants today who are also not insured. And we need to look at outreach on different strategies that target different employment groups, et cetera. So thank you very much for being here. It's again, all of this is about real people's lives, and we very much appreciate it.
I just wanted to clarify, there's often this confusion. I'm with Unite Here Health, the health plan for the Hotel and Restaurant Workers Union.
Thank you very much for that clarification.
Hi there, Stephanie Hodson with United Ways of California and 211 California. We also wanted to add our thanks to the staff for their thoughtful work on the stakeholder engagement options that they presented. We like the staff recommendation to do these topic-specific advisory groups, but we would encourage you guys to begin this process sooner rather than later so that we can get the most benefit from it possible in consideration of looming deadlines and things that we talked about, like the Level 2 grants and things like that. Perhaps that one's really soon, so perhaps it can't happen quite that quickly, but also to inform the work that's already happening of the vendors and contractors.
Thank you very much. If I could ask you to pause just a moment, we have a caller on the line. Operator, would you open the line, please?
Please go ahead, Dorina. Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Can I just go ahead now?
Yes, and identify yourself, please.
Oh, my name is Dorina Wong. I'm with the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, so thank you very much. I just have just several responses to what's been presented. With regard to the stakeholder engagement process, I think that we like the idea of having as much input into the decisions as possible, and agree that I believe it was Chad from the Latino Coalition that we're afraid of it being too exclusive, and we understand that there's a need to have a small working group, but we want to make sure that the different diverse communities have opportunities to provide input, and so we have a statewide network of API groups and small businesses that would like to provide additional input into some of those topic areas that have been in discussion already, especially the small health options program. And so to the extent that we can make sure that the different perspectives and different groups are incorporated, we would support that. So, by working with some of our partnerships and networks, like what we're trying to establish, we think that maybe it will be an opportunity to get regional input, because we're a statewide coalition, into these different areas. So the specific work groups we agree with, and the ad hoc meetings with the different networks and coalitions. In addition, in terms of the focus groups, I think we were wondering if it's at all possible to do it in other languages. I know that the timeline is very quick, but the second largest, obviously, limited English-speaking population is the Chinese-speaking population. And just like Peter identified that, when you translate marketplace and mercado in Spanish, there may be different ways that different cultural groups may interpret marketplace. And to reiterate Elizabeth's comments about, there's going to be a lot of people in the API community that will be going into the Medi-Cal expansion. That's actually not really a marketplace, because they're just going to be enrolled in those programs. So they're not really going to be paying anything to be in those programs. And there's going to be some confusion and misunderstanding. So finally, in terms of the, I think we want to support in the qualified health plans.
the idea of the eliminating the health disparities, in particular, the one criteria around ensuring that the plans have a network that is culturally and linguistically appropriate. We really want to reiterate that, because not only should the exchange be providing cultural and linguistic access, but the health plan itself, when the person is actually, or the provider itself, when the person is actually trying to get healthcare services, we need to make sure that, say, if they need an interpreter, they have it at that point of contact. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dorina. And Peter will take your question about the focus groups.
I think that we recognize very much that we need to do broader range of focus groups, and that's part of the planning process of looking at level two. We will not be done with message development when we submit level two. And we're looking at what we need to do in fall of this year. And one of the things we're asking of Ogilvy to advise us on, how many more focus groups of what levels, what varieties of both language, cultural, regional focuses we might do. And so I know we will not be able to do more than the ones that we have scheduled, which I believe is four more, English and Spanish, in the next month or so, but absolutely doing more before we sort of concretize language that will go out in a big way in 2013. Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Muller. I'm with the California Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems. I first want to very much appreciate the additional updated timeline and the guidelines that you put forward today. I had actually one clarifying question, and that was to just get a better understanding of whether you anticipate in the additional information that will be released on the qualified health plan, whether you anticipate there being some discussion and additional clarity on the essential community provider, or if you anticipate additional details on the definition of the ECP and kind of what role that will play in the qualified health plan to come a little bit later.
Thanks,
Thank
Sarah.
You.
Do you want to take that?
Yeah. Issues of essential community providers is central to the whole qualified health plan strategy. And so the timeline laid out relative to that is going to be the options in July and then final in August, as I recall. So, but that's a core element of having the right mix, right set of providers, including essential, and if there are non-essential, but other providers as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much. We are now going to move to our panel presentation on the small employer options. And for this panel, we from the board will move down to the front row, and the panel will take its place. And then we'll come back up and take public comment following that panel.
While folks are moving, I'll do a couple notes of introduction. As folks know, we've had landscape meetings in the past. Well, I'll wait a moment. Let's get the shuffling and let people come up and folks go down. So, what? Everyone stand up. Let's stand up. Everyone stand up. Come on. Stand. You got to stand up. I'll stand up too. So stretch a little bit. Oh, we've been here. We've got every 5 minutes. Wait a second. Wait a second. Okay. Good way to go. There's some people sitting down there. This is not thriving. Exactly. Thanks. Okay, folks, we're sitting down. We stretched. That was good. That was a seventh inning stretch. So as I get ready to introduce this panel, I want to note that over the last 6 months, okay, you guys, take it outside. Take it outside if you want to keep chatting. There we go. Okay. So over the past 6 months, we've provided a lot of material to the board on the Small Employer Health Options Program. And what we provided folks, and again, I'll ask people that are on the aisleways talking to move outside, please, in the most recent board material, we provided a summary of that material, which is available on our website, which links to about 15 or so substantive comments, letters we received, et cetera. Three things that I would in particular call out is at the December board meeting, we had a presentation from Pacific Community Ventures on small employer healthcare decision making. Was a very rich report that I want to appreciate the work they've done. In March, we shared with the board the product of work done by the Small Business Majority, which held, I think it was three forums from around the state, and the board has received that. Can we shut the door there, please? finally, among other things, we shared in February the issue of health affairs. And for those policy wonks, it's the publication of record, but it was actually an entire issue of about a dozen articles all on the future of the small business insurance exchanges. Having said that, I really can't tell you how pleased I am to have the panel of five individuals we have to share with the board and with all of you how to think about and how we're thinking about the Small Employer Health Options Program. We're going to start by having an overview from Sandy Hunt with Price Waterhouse, who we have commissioned to work in partnership with the exchange to help us craft and develop the options for the Small Employer Health Options Program. Sandy will be followed by John Gergerina. John is the CEO of the San Francisco Health Plan, but he was the president of the Pacific Health Advantage, and I had the pleasure of working with John for many years when I was at Pacific Business Group on Health. In terms of individuals that I've had on-the-ground experience with running a small employer choice product, John has as much or more experience as anyone in the entire country and actually understands this stuff well. He'll be followed by John Ehrensmeyer, the president of the Small Business Majority. Again, I noted the Small Business Majority really did a great service to the board by holding a series of meetings around the state that had a really wide and deep range of perspectives that I think have been very helpful. The board's appreciated that report. We're then grateful to have Roxana Bautista here from the Asian Pacific Islander American Health Forum to give a consumer perspective on how's the shop fit. And finally, last but not least, thank you very much to Dan Webb from Webb Insurance Group to give a broker perspective. One of the things we certainly know and heard from the work that Pacific Community Ventures did is for the vast majority of small businesses, they look to their broker. How do we understand that? How do we frame that as we go forward? So with that, I'm happy to turn it over to Sandy Hunt. Sandy?
Presentation? Is it up?
The presentations will appear magically right now.
Okay. There we go. Thank you. All right. Feels so powerful. Thank you, Peter. So what we were asked to do today is give you an overview of the work that we're doing with the exchange to help them to develop some of the parameters that will be considered for the shop specifically. We are also working with the exchange on the qualified health plan development, so that naturally interfaces with a lot of the work that needs to be done around the shop. So what we'll talk about fairly briefly is where we are right now in our engagement, what the landscape is for getting to the end, some of the key design considerations, and the next steps, and then we have a little bit more detail on the design considerations. So in terms of a timeline, you can see that we are currently looking at the federal regulations, state regulations, the existing programs, and we're looking at all of the inputs that are coming into the exchange. And again, we are not interacting directly with stakeholders. We're taking the information that comes through the exchange and is provided to us. But those stakeholder comments are important. We're looking at the market landscape in terms of how small employers are purchasing insurance today, what kind of products they're interested in, what health plans are in the market and where they are in the market, because California is a very big state and what's available in some regions is not the same as what's available in other regions. We will be developing draft exchange QHP and SHOP guidelines. Moving towards the next 2 months, we'll be working to complete some of those mission and guiding principles and then getting in July to the key design decisions. And those will all be things that need to come back to the board. Went too far. All right. Sorry, this little clicker is a little awkward. So the way we're thinking about this from a high level is that first, that the design decisions overlap very much between the shop and the individual exchange. So some of the decisions that have to be made are thinking about which ones are very unique to the shop and which are unique to the individual exchange and which overlap. We've divided the big issues into six categories: the product portfolio, QHP selection and management, employer and employee choice, which is a very big topic that we'll be spending quite a bit of time on. The marketing strategies, largely that is work that will feed off of the Ogilvy analyses, benefits administration, and the operational design. So drilling just a little bit into each of these, some of the things that we've been looking at are product choice. How much product choice? Should there always be both HMO and PPO plans available? How many plans available? How much should the offerings be standardized versus made more unique? And then what kinds of supplemental benefits will be offered, and will they always be part of a package, or will they be available separately? Some of the potential QHP standards alignment between the shop and the individual exchange, will the criteria be identical between the two? Are there reasons that they might be different? Haven't got to any recommendations yet. The plan participation in the shop and the individual exchange, again, how much should there be identical plans and how much differentiation might be appropriate? And methods to improve choice in underserved areas is a big focus. Again, we know that some parts of California have very few plans available to them, while others have endless choice, and what kinds of incentives can be given to plans to get them into some of those underserved areas. And then the degree of choice offered to employers and employees, is it going to be only employer choice, or will the employee have some level of choice as well? Moving on to some of the more operational aspects, how many people are expected to be interested in participating in the shop exchange? The enrollment estimates are very important to driving some of the other decisions around the cost that can be supported from an infrastructure perspective and getting into different sizes of employers, and issues like adverse selection also are driven off of some of those enrollment estimates. The marketing channels that are going to be needed to really get the message out to small employers and their employees about the value of the exchange, which also gets into the broker and agent payment structures. So those are some issues that we're talking about. And where the navigators specifically fit in for the shop as compared to the individual exchange. Some of the additional considerations are what other services might the shop offer to employers that would be of interest to them that would encourage participation in the shop versus the outside market. Things like helping to administer health savings accounts, for example, or COBRA administration, all of the other things that small employers have to think about that aren't part of their core business. And then finally, the operational processes and which services tactically that need to be provided through the exchange might be outsourced, whether those services, the entire administration is done in-house by state employees or is outsourced to a contractor, are among the considerations. And then, of course, the resources and timeline estimates of all of this that need to go into the Level 2 planning grant that will be submitted at the end of June. So in terms of the timeline, again, here we are at the board meeting providing information about the landscape. At the next board meeting, we will be bringing a number of issue papers for the board's consideration. I don't believe those will be voted on at that board meeting, but they will be at least available for review. In June, at the June 12th board meeting, the expectation is that there will be specific recommendations that drive out of those topic papers. And again, I don't know if there'll be a vote at that point or not. But at the following board meeting on June 19th, some significant decisions that will need to be made. And then moving into July is the timeline for beginning to develop the shop and to make a decision about what will be outsourced and if there's going to need to be a procurement for that. We did provide some additional detail in the appendix of the presentation. Do you want me to go through that? Okay. I'm not going to go through these details here, but they are in the presentation document if you want to go through them yourselves. But these are some of the very specific questions that we're addressing in our work. And turn it back over.
Who sets up the next one? Or is it just
rolling? It's magic. That guy back there.
Okay, I'm John Gregorina. I used to be the president of PAC Advantage. So some of those scars are coming back. So as for the expectations, I had somebody take me aside before I came in here saying that they saw the slides and they expect me to be blunt, very direct, and that I have some strange slides to show you, and that's because that when you want to overcome previous pain, you have to do it with humor. So we go back in the history of PAC Advantage. It was a small employer purchasing pool, a nonprofit pool that operated for 13 years, serving small employers between the sizes of 2 to 50 employees, and has an awful lot of lessons to learn. The first thing that I would say is that PAC Advantage is very similar to the shop exchange in that it is a voluntary exchange. That means that health plans could decide to participate or stay in the market. It means that the brokers, the distribution arm, brokers and general agencies could decide to participate or they could go ahead and sell in the open market. And small employers themselves could choose to purchase in the exchange or they could purchase in the marketplace. And so from that perspective, the first question to the shop exchange is, what is your value to those three customers? What is your sales pitch? Why does any health plan want to participate with you? Why does an insurance agent or broker want to sell you? And why does a small employer want to enroll with you? And when you look at those options of what the shop has, the shop exchange is very different from the individual exchange. The individual exchange has a tremendous selling card. It has subsidies, large subsidies, and the only place you can get it. It operates like a large employer. That is a huge value proposition. On the shop side, you can't sell that you are going to be the lowest cost. In fact, the law is quite clear. Whatever prices that a health plan offers in the shop exchange, those exact same benefits and exact same prices are in the marketplace. So there is no sale of this will be the cheapest place. That leaves you with two strong selling points. One, the idea of unrestricted choice, that you could pick, employees could potentially, depending on what the board selects, could pick whatever choice is right for them from a plan perspective. And secondly, the tax credits that beginning in 2014 for employers who are 25 employees, full-time equivalents or less, whose average wages are $50,000 or less, and the employer is paying up to 50% of the employee-only policy, can receive up to a 50% tax credit for 2 years and can only get it in the shop exchange. That's a value to be selling. The other thing from the PAC Advantage experience is to realize is that the shop exchange is a sales organization. When the shop exchange opens, you know how many members it will have? And now I'll go ahead and I'll lead into, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm a huge Oakland Raiders fan. Hall of Fame center for the Raiders was Jim Otto. He was well known because his numbers were 0-0. The shop exchange has zero enrollment. And the vast majority of the enrollment it will pick up, needs to be honest, it's going to be taking from what's in the marketplace today. What that means is this is a competitive marketplace and a sales job, and the shop exchange needs to compete and to sell. Additionally, the shop exchange, learning from PAC Advantages and many other voluntary purchasing pool experiences, is it needs to avoid adverse selection at all costs. Adverse selection is that the group that's in the exchange is less healthy than the overall market. Prices go up, it doesn't work. The voluntary plans say, this isn't working for me, and I'm going to go ahead and leave. The shop exchange needs to guard against unrealistic expectations. I have already seen reports in the newspapers of people talking about the shop exchange will lower rates than the market today. Once again, we already talked about the law is quite clear. The prices will be the same. They won't be lower. And I've also heard reports of people thinking there's going to be 1 million or 2 million people in the shop exchange. Again, it starts with zero, and it needs to take from what's in the marketplace today. Yes, there will be some uninsured businesses who will join for the first time. That's great. There will be some new businesses that are formed for the first time, and they'll join the shop exchange. That's great. but the vast majority of the enrollment is going to come from what's in the marketplace today already. And then lastly, and we're going to spend some time, and this is where the fun slides are, the Shop Exchange Board and everyone else needs to recognize the motivations of plans and what's in their best interest. So there are three lessons that we learned at PAC Advantage. The first one is the plans want the whole plate of enchilada. They don't want what they call sliced business. So if there is a small business of 40 employees and there's a sales going on, that health plan wants that group of 40 for themselves first. Secondly, they'll take it in California's marketplace against a non-Kaiser plan. We'll take that against Kaiser, so it's the non-Kaiser plan in Kaiser with certain parameters that that plan has to get, say, at least 50% of the enrollment to protect themselves from an adverse selection standpoint. So it's very clear from a health plan perspective, number one, I want that entire group myself. Number two, I'll take it alongside a Kaiser Permanente, just with myself alongside a Kaiser. And number three, I'll turn to the exchange, and I'm worried about this sliced business, because if there's a group of 40, maybe Kaiser takes 15, maybe another plan takes 5, another plan takes 10, and I'm left with 10 employees. And what's the risk mix of those 10 that I have in my slice versus the overall slice? This is why PAC Advantage, in order to survive as long as it did, turned away from the open choice model of pick anything to we had a new set of products that was Kaiser and Blue Shield, Kaiser and Health Net, Kaiser and Aetna, and the employer picked which non-Kaiser plan they wanted, and that was the choice from the employee's perspective to improve the risk mix. The second lesson is that the plans, and they have a very good reason to fear cannibalization. Many of these plans participate in the market today, and they have rather large books of business. The last thing they want to do is take their book of business in the small group market that they have today, that they control, they have the relationship with the employers and the brokers, and then watch that bleed off into an exchange where a couple of not-so-good things happen. Number one, choice becomes available. So all those groups that were all theirs now going to the exchange, and some of those very same members they were receiving premium for are now picking some other plan. So what it means is that, first of all, you'll never see a situation where there's a cheaper price in the exchange than the market because it'll blow up their block of business. But secondly, they'll do a lot what they can to protect their current block and look to see what's the additional piece I can pick up from an exchange. I sure do hope the exchange goes and takes a big part of a block of business to some other plan that's not a part of the exchange. And then thirdly, the big lesson was that the plans are the bigger bully. So there really seems to be this understanding that the exchange, by getting as many small businesses together as they possibly can, pulling them together in one large group, is going to kind of act like Costco. And we're buying peanut butter, and we're getting a big jar, so it's a lot cheaper. Health insurance isn't peanut butter, and it's all about the risk mix of that group. And so what happens here is the idea that the exchange or the shop exchange is going to get so big that Peter's going to have this hammer and start whacking the health plans over the head and getting lower prices isn't going to happen. At the end of PAC Advantage, we had 70,000 lives with Kaiser Permanente. 70,000 lives is a lot of lives. But at that given point in time, Kaiser Permanente had over 700,000 lives in the small business marketplace. So we were less than 10% of their business. My ability to walk in and tell Kaiser what to do was not there. In fact, this is me with the glasses. And I guess what I can say is I'm thankful that Kaiser didn't give me a wedgie, that they just pulled my shirt up. But the idea that the shop exchange is going to walk in and start telling health plans what to do in the marketplace where they don't control the vast majority of the enrollment isn't going to happen and is only going to cause problems if those expectations are there. So the question is, what are the things and what are the best practices, the things that the shop exchange needs to take in and keep at the forefront of the mind? The first thing is to avoid adverse selection is you must follow all the rules in the marketplace, even if you don't like them. If the shop exchange says, I've got a problem with that one, we're going to do it differently. The brokers, the small businesses, everyone will find a way to be able to find a better price somewhere else and to be able to ship risk into the exchange if it does not follow all of the practices in the marketplace. Secondly, and I can't stress this one enough, and I know that a couple of the speakers will address this, health insurance for small businesses is not owners walking up to the shop exchange like Field of Dream and knocking on the doors to say, I'm here, what can I buy? In the entire 13-year history of HIPAA and PAC Advantage, only one employer knocked on the door to purchase. Everything else was a sale, and it's insurance agents and brokers and general agencies that have these relationships with the small businesses. And I can tell you, as someone who purchases health insurance for my employees, I have a broker as well. And as much as I know about health insurance, this is not the fun time of the year when you're going through this. Small business owners are relying upon insurance agents and brokers and even general agencies to help sell and maintain these blocks of business. The shop exchange has to treat the insurance agents and brokers and general agencies like the rest of the marketplace and be able to have them want to be a part of that shop. Thirdly, there has to be strong relationships with the plans that participate. I know that there's a lot of angst about let's beat up those dumb old health plans. They're the ones causing all the price increases. But at the end of the day, what the shop exchange is selling is health plans. It's health insurance. And if what you're selling is someone that you have a bad relationship with, in a voluntary environment, they can get up and walk away. And then what are you selling? Not much. So there needs to be strong relationships with the plans that participate. There also needs to be, and I can't stress this enough, I know you say this, and everyone says, well, of course, we're going to provide excellent service. Outstanding service is a focus and an energy and an effort that is unlike anything else to be able to deliver it. And what happens in this marketplace is for insurance agents and brokers to be able to convince some employer, it's almost like dating, I'm going to bring you in and get you a new policy. That thing has to flow through quickly with the least amount of problems possible. And if there are nightmares and it ain't working at the place that's enrolling that group, it's not good for that broker or agent, and it's not good for the business. And I can assure you, insurance agents and brokers talk amongst themselves, and small business owners talk amongst themselves. And if there is an outstanding service from day one, there isn't going to be much more membership beyond the gym auto. And so with that, I will turn it over to the next speaker.
Okay. I'm John Arnsmeyer. I'm the CEO of Small Business Majority. And, I'm really here to talk about the shop exchange from the point of view of the small business owner. And some of what I'm going to say, you know, may run somewhat in conflict with what you just heard from John about some of the realities out there. And we acknowledge that, and we think all of the stakeholders have to work together. But I think it's important that at least we put on the table, you know, what small business owners are looking for. We are an organization founded and run by small business owners. We are national, though we are based here in California, and we do far more work in California than in any other state. We, in addition to advocacy and outreach to small businesses, we also do a lot of research. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And healthcare has been we're a multi-issue organization, but healthcare has been our single biggest issue since we started, just because of the incredible importance it is to small businesses. What I'm going to go over is not exhaustive. I mean, I'm going to try to focus on the points that we've isolated as being of particular importance to small businesses. Obviously, other issues such as the robust competition of health plans, the integrity and robustness of the risk pool, so that we avoid adverse selection, are really important. But we're out doing research and outreach to small businesses, both scientific and non-scientific. We're continuing to do research, so we will continue to be updating our recommendations. We're constantly seeking information from business owners, both in terms of our interaction with them and formal research, and we will continue to share that with the board. It's absolutely true that you cannot sell against the outside market with cost. We do happen to believe, and I don't think we need to get into this in detail, that there is an opportunity to maybe perhaps affect costs in the overall market, but it is absolutely true that you're not going to be able to sell costs in the exchange versus outside the exchange. Now, obviously, the tax credit is a factor for a large number of businesses, although the dollar amounts are not huge, but it is a factor. As John said, you can only get the small business tax credit in the exchange. That said, it pales in magnitude, it pales by comparison to the subsidies that are going to be available in the individual market. So obviously, we have to recognize that, as John said, this is basically a competitive process. The exchange has to look at this as any business would, appealing to its customers. Again, we recognize there are other stakeholders. You have to have plans or else you don't have products to sell. But the fact is I'm here to sort of talk about what the small business customers are looking for. And whether or not you can sell outside, you can compete outside the market on costs, we still have to remember everything else we're talking about here, cost is still the single biggest issue. I think we need to keep this in mind for any small business owner who's considering buying a plan on the exchange or outside the exchange, and we still have an interest in as many small business owners buying plans of some sort, although we think that the exchange offers, can really offer itself as the best place to go for this. Cost is still king. And the other thing to remember is that small businesses are very diverse and very, each is unique in terms of size, profit margin, the type of business it is, employee makeup, and also, obviously, culture, diversity, different languages. So we need to keep that in mind as we're setting this up. Small businesses are looking for, they have diverse needs. So the exchange has to be set up to have products that will satisfy a diverse set of needs. And it's got to be differentiated from the outside markets, as we said. So how does it offer value? Now, we talk about diverse needs. I mean, we know there's some benefits to benefit standardization. We know there are exchanges that are currently, small business exchanges currently operating out there, New York and Connecticut and other places. Some have benefit standardization, some don't. We realize that those that do, there's less choice, so there's a balance here. But at the end of the day, there has to be enough products on there to reach at least a big enough market out there of small businesses. Okay, as John said, we wholeheartedly agree. This is not going to work without brokers, period. We know this from experience of other exchanges. You know this just by logic. Brokers and agents must be an integral part of this. They cannot have any incentive to sell against the exchange. It just isn't going to work, period. Moreover, that's where small businesses get most of their information, and that's where they have the trusted relationships. As John said, even he's got, with his expertise, he's got a trusted relationship with his broker. In the research that we participated in about a year ago, 75% of small businesses of fewer than 20 employees use brokers, and 88% of those owners say their broker's opinion carries significant weight. The compensation of brokers has to be competitive with the outside market. It just isn't going to work otherwise. Marketing and outreach. In addition to brokers, we already talked about the diversity and the different types of businesses, so a lot of different channels have to be looked at. Obviously, outreach has to be in different languages, has to take into account different cultures and different businesses. There are other entities out there, other individuals in small business owners' lives, accountants, relationships perhaps with business organizations like local chambers of commerce and trade groups. The outreach has to take into account all of those relationships and provide information, reach out through those organizations. This is what we do in our outreach to businesses across the state. We touch on all of these entities and individuals who have trusted relationships with small business owners. As a longtime small business owner myself, I know that when it came to healthcare, I was always looking for advice elsewhere, whether it's from a broker or someone else, and that is absolutely essential that all the outreach recognize that. Obviously, there's plenty of work to go around for a lot of different people in this process to get the word out to the 700,000 small business owners in California. Okay, I know this is controversial, and I'm here to simply say that while there are issues, vis-a-vis the plans with employee choice, I want everybody to understand employers like choice. In the research we did by a 2-to-1 ratio, employers would prefer to have a broader range of options that their employees can access. And again, this obviously has to be balanced against, making sure that you're addressing the needs of the plans who you obviously need in the exchange. But it's important to recognize that this is something that is extremely important to small businesses. And as the two previous speakers have mentioned, the type of services that the exchange can provide, this is, again, we're looking for competitive advantages for the exchange. What can the exchange do that the outside market can't do as well? Well, over time, the exchange can set up, can provide some of these extra services like COBRA administration, wellness plans, Section 125, administration of HSAs, FSAs, HRAs, et cetera. Exchange needs to be looking at this as something that adds to their competitive value. Small business owners are busy, and we're always looking for edges and angles to what we can get without, exhausting our time. Most of us don't have HR staffs to deal with this stuff. So whatever the exchange can do is sort of HR in a box, that is absolutely going to be helpful and make the exchange more more competitive. And I should just want to highlight the wellness programs. We've heard a lot from small business owners. They want to participate in workplace wellness programs. I'm not necessarily talking about programs where the premiums are different. I'm simply talking about access to wellness programs as a point where their employees can get access to that stuff. And the exchange, I think, has an opportunity to play a role in that, to be a clearinghouse for some of the programs that are out there. That's actually something we're going to be spending some time focusing on going forward. Again, I want to stress the exchange, and you've heard this from others, exchange has to have a customer service mentality. There's a competitive, it's going to be a competitive world out there with the outside market. Small businesses need to be looked upon as any business would look on a customer. A strong launch is going to be essential. It's got to work. The exchange has to work. It can't have problems. The PR would be a PR disaster if it did. As John said, small business owners talk a lot with each other. So it's really important that we think of this again, like any business would think of launching a new product, and let's get it right out of the box. Maybe it doesn't have all the bells and whistles as a result, but there needs to be a path to get to some of those bells and whistles. Flexibility is critical, and again, it's got to obviously address the needs of all of its stakeholders. Finally, if anybody has any questions, my colleague David Chase is available to provide information to anyone on research we have and other information we have. So.
Hello, my name is Roxana Bautista. I'm the National Network Director at the Asian and Pacific Islander American Health Forum. We are based in San Francisco, and we do policy analysis at the state and federal levels, and to the communities that we serve, we provide technical assistance and some funding to them. So I'm here today to talk about the consumer advocate perspective, and I wanted to paint this picture of a segment of the community that we are concerned about. So the worker at the small business is a legal permanent resident here, maybe for less than 5 years. They have low income, like under 138% federal poverty level. But because of the five-year bar, this person does not qualify for Medicaid except in 12 states, including California and Washington, D.C. So penalties for the individual mandate are lower than premiums in either regular or shop exchange, on top of which their employer is so small that they don't meet the shop exchange opportunities. So they end up paying the penalties instead of paying for insurance, and they remain uncovered and will remain persistently uncovered. So while this person technically could qualify for Medi-Cal in California, there's so many complexities in enrollment, including language, immigration status, and there's creating barriers for enrollment. And also for their children, it's also becoming complicated. And I'm also talking about the mixed status families, where one or more family members might have different immigration status compared to the other family members. And there's complications, definitely, based on the immigration-based restrictions. And there's confusion. And for folks that may be very eligible for coverage are denied the coverage. And specifically in California, there is a majority of the Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander owned small businesses. We have a lot of them in the state. There's over 500,000 Asian-owned businesses and over 9,000 Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander-owned businesses. But many of these small businesses have no paid employees. They're mom-and-pop shops. They came here to for a better life, and they don't pay themselves. They just want to do the business. And therefore, they're ineligible for the small business tax credit or access to insurance plans in the shop exchange. And they'll have to purchase plans in the individual exchange. So it's really important that California have a strategy for enrolling those self-employed Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander businesses, as well as other communities of color businesses in these individual exchanges as a valid option to cover these populations. And we should try to include these strategies in other materials for enrollment. And specifically, would be great is, you know, to have California partner with, and some comments have already been made with chambers of commerce, organizations, to really have those partnerships help with the navigators, the assistants, and also just to help maybe design and participate in the focus groups. And definitely we see that there is a cost-effective method of decreasing language barriers when we provide some language assistance. There's a recent study of Medi-Cal participation which found that new enrollment among Latinos and Asians increased when there was bilingual applicant assistance provided. So we really would love that to happen. In terms of communicating these different options out, we'd love to have it in different traditional and non-traditional formats. A lot of our communities of color also listen to radio or read newspapers. So is there a way to get the information out there? I'm from the community. A lot of folks still kind of are confused at what to do, how to do, who do I talk to. And so as much information can be out there in their languages, where they're at, would be extremely beneficial. We support California's commitment to provide Medi-Cal coverage for the lawfully present immigrants with no five-year waiting period. But for those immigrants with incomes that are too high for Medicaid and too low to afford plans offered through the exchange, we really encourage that California should offer a basic health plan to provide coverage for Californians with incomes between 133 to 250% of the federal poverty level. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Dan Webb, and I'm immediate past president for the California Association of Health Underwriters, and I'm the owner of a small business, which happens to be a health insurance agency, called DSJ Insurance Services, and we're located in Bakersfield. So if I talk slow and don't use big words, well, that's, you know, I'm just reflective of my community. What can I tell you? There have been some very interesting things that have been said that I have enjoyed greatly being here today. And, of course, with all the guys talking about the value of the agent and brokers, that, you know, that rings true to my heart. But one of the things I want to point out, we heard a gentleman come up here. Noberto told his story about how he wanted coverage. And I'll bet that everybody in here, or most people in here anyway, had the same reaction. You wanted to do something to help him. You wanted to do something to make his life better. You wanted to help fix the problem. That's why we're here. It's one of the things that we all share in common. We've got people that can't get health insurance or don't know that they can get health insurance, and we want to help them do that. Well, the shop exchange is going to be one of those things that works and works very well, I think. As agents and brokers, we want to be a part of the mix, and we want to see the problems fixed, because just like we heard from Noberto down here, we hear that every day when we go out and we enroll people, and we hear, as agents and brokers, we hear the stories every single day. I can't tell you the stories that I hear about people that need help and what needs to be done and how we need to make it, how do we get it fixed. So it's something that's very near and dear to most of us as agents and brokers. We want to see the shop exchange work, and we think that we can be a very important part of it. We are sales and marketers. We sell products. We don't need to tell you how to build the product out. What we need to do is get out there and get the word to people and sell it, because the truth is the stuff doesn't sell itself. Just one of the comments that was made up here earlier about little two-man mom-and-pop groups that can't get health insurance. Well, they can get health insurance in the state of California, guaranteed issue under the 2 to 50 marketplace. There's a way to do it, and a knowledgeable health insurance agent makes that happen for that group. And am I not mistaken that the shop exchange is going to be 1 to 100? It's not 1 to, still 2 to 50. Okay, 2 to 50. Same deal. We can make it work for the mom and pop organizations, because we know the market and we know how it works. We know how to put the things through. But here's an interesting thing about health insurance agents. When we talk about service and we talk about the importance of service, if on average a health insurance agent is going to spend 20% of his time marketing new product, he's going to spend 80% of his time servicing his existing client base. Most health insurance agents sell new product through referral. If you don't do a good job as a health insurance agent, you starve. If you do a good job, you get more customers. You're motivated to go out and get the business by doing the good job, taking care of the people, doing the right thing for the people. And when it comes to the shop exchange and it comes to selling product, there are some things that the shop exchange can do. Create it. Yes, it's got to be the same inside and out, right? Create a product that is just exactly what my partner next to me was talking about, a basic health plan where we can take people that cannot afford health insurance now and give them a basic plan that gives them a start that gets them coverage. And I guarantee you, even though it would be offered inside and outside the exchange, there would be a tendency of putting it in the exchange because it's the exchange that came up with the idea. And agents would do that all day long, place it in the exchange because it gave them a new tool to work with all their people. And it's just one of those things that we need. We need lower cost. And you can look at it however you want. You can't take a Cadillac and sell it at a Hyundai price. There have been companies that have tried it year in and year out. They're going to lose money on each individual product, but they're going to make it up on volume, right? Doesn't work. Never works. Give us the low-cost product that we can go out and sell. We can make it work. When it comes to working with Navigators, when it comes to working with Promoteras, when it comes to working with the community-based organizations, it's one of the things that we really need to develop. We need to come up with the idea to make that work, because when you look at the uninsured in California, yes, insurance agents have enrolled a lot of people. We've enrolled a lot of people, but they're, you know, let's pick a number, 8 million. 8 million people uninsured. We haven't been able to reach. We need to tie into better into our communities to make those work, to reach to those people and be able to get the story to them. And it's got to be working in cooperation with one another. One last thing, and I believe this, at the end of the day, when we look at it, if each one of us goes away from the table just a little bit upset, I think we got a great compromise. I think we got something that worked, because everybody put skin in the game, everybody lost a little bit, everybody gained a little bit. Thanks.
Thank you very much. What we're going to do now, we have a mic down here for the board to ask questions of the panel. And see if they have questions, observations they'd like to have fleshed out. And then we're going to switch and ask the panel to leave and the board come back up here to have the last round of public comments. So, Katie, any board members have questions? And before we have the panel stand down. Well, we've generally actually restrained the question was, why don't we let the public ask questions of the panels? Is that public commentary, we generally haven't opened up to ask questions of every panel because we would never end, with all due respect to the public's comments process. And so we've enabled comments that have been more closed-ended. But I'm more than happy to open it up for, if the board rather, for public comment, and they can then comment on as well. The board is noting that. So let's actually open it up for public comment, except for Dr. Ross, which is going to kick it off. But if individuals want to make comments from the public, please step up over here. But we'll start with Dr. Ross.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. You've managed to insult the stakeholders, the health plans today, and I'm not sure it was, but
great job. I'm following Dan Webb's of you. If I could leave everyone leaving a little dissatisfied, I figure I've done my job, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you. Great presentations. I would be interested in hearing from Dan in particular or John. What is the mood out there among the brokers about the exchange and the shop exchange? Is it great anticipation and excitement and enthusiasm, or is it, oh, my God, what is this thing? Is it fear? Can you just kind of give us a sense of how the broker community out there is feeling about this new beast coming our way?
Sure. It's definitely not great anticipation. There's no point in singing you some song that's just completely false. I do think that with the ACA, with the passing of the ACA, the one thing that was there were there were great big holes that needed to be filled in. It's not that the concept is we don't need health care reform. We do need health care reform. We do need a way to work on our problems, and you got to start someplace. And so we start with the ACA, but big giant holes in there. And now as it's starting to pare down, the holes are getting smaller, but there are still questions. I mean, there's a serious question when we talk about ratios and plans, and we talk about going from a 6 or 7 to 1 ratio down to a 3 to 1 ratio. You know, it's a concern of all agents that you're going to produce a product that's going to greatly increase in price, and that's an issue. But it's a wait and see attitude. I mean, there are a lot of people like me that see the reality of it and want to get involved in the stream and help be a part of the solution, not part of the problem. And I would say that that would be 90% of insurance agents, that they want to be a part of the solution. They're just not sure where that comes yet.
John, do you have anything to
add? I think the one thing that I would add is the experience from the HIPAA and PAC Advantage is it's like that first date and that first impression. So the HIPAA, which was created at a time during Clinton health care reform where things were going to be very different, had a different policy of how they paid agents and brokers. It wasn't a popular one, and they never forgot it. So even years later, when PAC Advantage paid agents and brokers the same as the market rate, I would still have brokers take me aside and say, "Ain't you that nasty government thing that doesn't pay us the same?" So when you're making your policies and your decisions up front, this is what's going to stay with you, even if you make changes later on. So this is your first chance to set off on the footing with the agent and broker community, and I would do it well.
Good. Kim, please.
I had a question about employee choice. So, John, you talked about the whole enchilada. Kind of the plan perspective is there's some anxiety or concerns about too much choice, the slicing point you mentioned. And then our other John, we heard that employers like choice and the opportunity to provide a broader range of options to employees. Sandy, what do we know about the research around what employees, what individuals think about choice? Do we have some evidence, either in the research literature or Johnny G from the HIPAA and PAC Advantage, of is the paired approach you just articulated, is that viewed by individuals as an improvement in choice, or is it really unfettered choice in terms of all the plan offerings?
That is one of the topics that we'll be bringing you a paper on at the next board meeting. I think what we know is people like choice, but I think we also know there's some evidence in Massachusetts, for example, where they have gone from unfettered choice to much narrower and more standardized benefit designs, because too much choice is very confusing to employees. So I think there's boundaries around what is a good level of choice, but certainly an idea of wanting some choice is out there.
I would add to Sandy's comments, at one point early on when PAC Advantage took over for the HIPAA, there were 3 different benefit packages and probably a dozen plans participating. So each employee would get multiple sheets of paper showing them all the choices and the rates that they had, and it is almost that overwhelming piece. And I think that if you take a look at what purchasers do, take a look at CalPERS, there isn't the choice that there was there 15 years ago. There's Kaiser and Blue Shield, and then there's a PPO choice. And most employers do that. They are restricting those choices to be able to make sure that the selection is working so they can keep those plans available. I think every employee would like to have as many options as they possibly can, both in benefit structure as well as with health plan choice. But to the extent that it is super broad, there is tremendous opportunity for adverse selection.
So both Dan and John respond. This is a major issue.
I would like to respond. That was one of the things I didn't mention earlier, talking about employee choice. One of the things that you see with employers, in my experience in actually just selling the product, is that employers want the choice for their employees, and this is in a lot of cases is a very selfish reason. You've got employees that only want a PPO. They don't want to see an HMO. They don't want to be involved with an HMO at all. Well, and vice versa. It can be the other direction. If you offer multiple choices to them, the employees can select the thing that they want, and the employees at least have the appearance of being happier. So it keeps the crowd from roaring. The other thing is that the employer can select his cost point. so that he can control cost. He's not opening it up and saying, you know, I'll pay 100% employee-only rate for any plan that you pick. No, he picks the one plan. He controls his cost. He dials the number in, but then he still, at no additional cost to him, gives his employees more choice. There are ways to dial it down. Anthem Blue Cross has got a great plan called Employee Elect, where they have some, you know, and I apologize to Anthem for getting numbers wrong, but it could be 25 or 30 plans that are in there. The employer can go in and offer all 25 or 30, or he can offer only 4 or 5 or 2 or 3, and he has options in there where he can do it, and it's all covered from the employee. He only sees the 4 or 5, so choice is better when you're at the selling point.
I would agree with what Sandra and John have said, that unfettered choice is not the answer. I mean, there is a point at which, for both the employer and ultimately the employee making the choice, it's really confusing. But it is true, and as Dan said, that sometimes it's almost a perception of having choice, but actually, you know, employers and employees do like choice. And I think the exchange needs to remember that it's a competitive market, as John said. So what can the exchange do to have choices in its product offering that are not available on the outside market? Because ultimately, if the issue is to get enough people using the exchange, it's going to be vis-a-vis the outside market. And what features that are popular can be in there that are reasonable with proper boundaries in order to make the exchange more attractive.
Any other board member questions, comments before turning to the public? Just to be an equal opportunity offender, I can. Okay, let's please step up and introduce yourself.
Jim Mullen with Delta Dental. I wanted to kind of put a point of clarification from Ms. Hunt and Ms. Ehrensmeyer's, Mr. Ehrensmeyer's presentation. There seemed to be a sense that the dental benefit would be supplemental or could be offered somewhat subsequent to January 1, 2014. Let me know if I'm mischaracterizing what I'm reading. The essential health benefit package, the 10th category, is pediatric vision and oral care. So a state would not be certified by Health and Human Services if it went in and said we're only offering medical coverage. So I just wanted to offer that point so that we don't let that continue as a void as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Peter and members of the board, Al Schubert from VSP Vision Care. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and thank you for all of your good work on behalf of this enormous project. As you may recall, VSP is the largest insurer in the state of California by membership. We cover 1 in 3 Californians, 13.7 million people. And the applicability to the SHOP discussion at hand and to stakeholder engagement is the following. VSP covers 11,000 employers in the state of California, and referencing those 13.7 million people. 64% of those 11,000 employers are employers of 50 employees and less. So the issue that you have heard from me previously would have a significant impact, and that is the fact that standalone vision plans, like my organization, are not allowed to provide care in the exchange as it is currently constructed. From a SHOP point of view and to the entire California Exchange construct, there has been a significant development in the state of Maryland on this particular issue. The Maryland legislature has passed an exchange amendment that you may be familiar with. Their vehicle was legislative, may not be the case with this particular body. And like California, Maryland has a very transparent, inclusive process for stakeholder input. Peter, your counterpart in Maryland is Rebecca Pierce, and Tequila Terry is the person that is responsible for stakeholder input, of which organizations like us have been a part of. But the change in Maryland that just took place authorizes the certification of qualified vision plans to provide vision care on both a bundled basis and a standalone basis. This just took place and is sitting on Governor O'Malley's desk waiting to be signed. Our hope is that this action could provide a framework for further consideration by the California Health Benefits Exchange Board. Thank you very much.
Great. Al, thank you very much. And I just want to be clear that the board has not yet taken up, and that's part of what we're getting recommendations on and options on the scope and how to deal with issues like vision and how that's structured. So I just want to make sure there's not confusion that the board has not yet acted on the whole range of what these options are going to look like, but as you've heard the schedule in the coming months, it will be robustly. Please, Micah.
Hi, Michael Weinberg, Barrier Council. I brought some of my colleagues here, and now they're able to see why I'm such an enormous John Gergerina fan. Just because, thank you for your presentation.
Eventually. My mother thanks you too. Yeah. Thanks, Micah.
But I have a question for you. I completely agree that we're not going to be giving Peter an enormous hammer that he's going to be walking into insurers' offices with and say, "Come on, guys, give me what I want." However, there are opportunities, and you see this with the experience of CalPERS, you see this with the experience of other purchasing exchanges, to work in partnership with a group of insurers to help design products that achieve some of the goals that you might want in terms of, the feedback that you're getting from the market or what you want to do around delivery system reform. And so I guess my question to you would be, is there an advantage to having fewer partners or to having a larger chunk of different insurance companies' business for that kind of a constructive conversation rather than more of an aggressive negotiation?
I think it all starts off with the larger you can get the pool, the better off you are. And so the question really becomes one of how many plans and what plans are you going to bring to the table and what are they bringing to the table for you to be able to sell. So you might have a regional plan that has an incredible price that you want inside there in order to help sell in that area. You definitely need to be able to build good blocks of business with the plans that are inside the exchange to have the conversations that you just discussed, which is what tweaks and changes do we want to make to the benefit to be able to try and drive some cost efficiencies over time. What you need is the shop to be a partner with these plans at the table.
Thank you, Micah. Susie?
Hello, Susie Shoup with California Coverage and Health Initiatives. Thanks for the chance to comment today. This was a really interesting discussion, and I just wanted to comment that I think it's fantastic that Pricewaterhouse is looking at the role of navigators in the shop, and I totally agree with Mr. Ehrensmeyer, who says that there's more than enough work to go around. Many of us are thinking about the role of navigators across the two different parts of the exchange, and I just wanted to say that I think there is an important function for navigators in the shop. I think that many minority-owned businesses are less familiar with using agents and brokers and may be more comfortable working with a navigator. There's also many different complex family situations where people have multiple different types of coverage options and will need to go back and forth between the two exchanges or get coverage with both exchanges, and think that navigators can serve an important connective role if they are present in a robust way in both exchanges. And I wanted to thank Mr. Webb for his comments. I think there's wonderful opportunities for community-based organizations and navigators to work together with agents and brokers. I know a lot of the groups that I represent work very closely and do cross-referral with brokers and agents in their local communities, so we look forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susie.
Anthony Wright with Health Access California. I just had a question of the panel, which is a broad one, which just simply, given the level of information or lack of information among small business owners who would likely be the ones that could benefit from the shop exchange, what advice would you have to the exchange and to the broader community about marketing outreach, how quickly to start up in getting those messages out, and what would you start with to start preparing planting the seeds to generate their interest? I mean, just like in a movie theater right now, you're seeing the trailers for movies in 2013 and 2014. What can we start to do to prepare the groundwork for, especially since there's a lot of misinformation that's out there, especially among the specific community?
I think we can start yesterday. I mean, we've noticed in the last 2 years a huge difference in response from small businesses, small business organizations. Small business organizations with whom we partner didn't want to hear about this 2 years ago. Now they're interested. 2014 doesn't seem that far away. Anthony's absolutely right. There is tremendous misinformation out there, tremendous lack of information. I mean, it's really amazing when we either do an in-person presentation or we do a webinar where we do a survey before and after, the level of knowledge just skyrockets when they just get some information. So it's you know, it's not too soon. I mean, obviously, if you're actually going out and selling, you know, hey, we got this exchange, maybe it's not, we're not quite ready for that yet because it needs to be something. But going out and talking about everyone, all stakeholders, who all of us have connections to small business in some way, I think it's really important. And I think it's happening now. People want to hear that something's, you know, not that far off. And just getting honest, factual information to people is what we want to do.
I think, too, that just like politics being local, so is the selling of health insurance to small businesses. Typically, you don't, as an insurance agent in Bakersfield, I don't sell a lot of business in San Francisco. I'm going to sell a lot of business in Bakersfield. So we need to have the system set in place. We need to have the navigators. We need to know who the players are. We need to put it needs to be packaged in such a way so that when the door opens, marketing-wise, we're going to have 5 or 6 touches with each individual or each company for them to realize what's actually going on. They're going to hear it from different places. They may see it on TV. They may hear it on radio. But what we need to have is in each of our communities, we need to be set and ready to go so that when they grasp on the idea, the marketing approach, we've already got something that's in place, ready to go. We know all the players, and we can sell right then and there.
I would say the comment that we're seeing some previews for movies in 2013 and 14, and that is true, but for the most part, you're seeing those previews heavily aired a few months before that thing actually hits the theater. And so while I think it's important for us to get information out now, I think it's that 3 to 6 months before the doors open with the brokers and the navigators, and there's a great opportunity between brokers and navigators. Brokers in there with an employer group that has 30 employees, some of those employees are part-time employees who are not going to be eligible for the employer plan. They are going to be eligible for the individual exchange with the subsidy. To be able to get that information out and link brokers and navigators together so that there is an answer for almost every single person in that group, that's going to be that opportunity, and there's going to be a lot of requirements from the shop to be able to be sending people out there to train insurance agents, brokers, and navigators about what this is and how it works.
With that, I'd actually turn it to the chair. Does she have we need to call for a motion to adjourn, I believe. But so moved. Is there a second? It has been seconded from the front row. Any further action? By acclamation, I do want to join Diana and apologize that we started late and ran a little bit late. You'll get updates from us on future board meetings. And thank you very much for this panel. This has been very important, feeding our work. Thank you all very much. Good day.